Welcome to the Iran Podcast. I'm Negar Mortazavi in Washington, D.C. In this episode, I speak with Congressman Ro Khanna from California. We'll talk about U.S. foreign policy towards Iran and the greater Middle East. We'll discuss how U.S. sanctions impact tech companies and their users in Iran. We'll talk about social media toxicity and the rise of the far right in the United States. Congressman Khanna represents California's 17th district in the heart of Silicon Valley, and he's the deputy whip of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Congressman Khanna, thank you very much for joining the Iran Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start with U.S. policy towards Iran. There's a new administration in the White House, and President Biden wants to revive diplomacy. There are currently negotiations happening in Vienna, which is a complete U-turn from the previous administration's policy. But there's also been a delay of about 3 months before this process really began. And you have said that the Biden administration had a disappointing start towards Iran. What do you think the administration should do at this moment?
They should empower Rahm Emanuel. He was an inspired choice. There seemed to be very positive movement once he was picked. But then he was basically kept in the bullpen for the first few months. I mean, he wasn't able to do anything. And some of us spoke out in Congress, Senator Murphy, myself, and others. And we, as a progressive caucus, spoke out. And I think that has moved the administration now to take it seriously. And now Rahm Emanuel is trying his best out there. The challenges we're running up against the Iranian election. But the more latitude, the more they can empower Rahm Emanuel, the better.
Mm-hmm. And as these discussions continue in Vienna, how do you see the role of America's closest allies in Europe in facilitating diplomacy and potentially follow-on negotiations on other issues than the nuclear program, which President Biden has mentioned?
Well, I think they've been trying since 2017 to convince the Americans that this is not in our interest to get pulled out of the deal, that it's just going to lead Iran to enrich more uranium. It's not enforceable, given how many other countries are still containing and keeping relationships with Iran. So my sense is that Europe is committed to assisting us in getting an agreement. But the challenge is, how much are we willing to do? And we ought to take the first step in lifting the sanctions, though reserving the right to put them right back on. And candidly, now, how much is Iran willing to do? As they head in an election year with more hardline candidates, it's unclear if there will be a partner on the other side. And so the delay has made it harder.
What about U.S. allies and partners in the region? We know Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Israel have been opposed to the nuclear deal and tried very hard to stop an agreement between Tehran and Washington. How should the Biden administration approach these regional allies who oppose diplomacy between Tehran and Washington?
Well, the United States, it's in our interest to get a deal with Iran and not to get in some perpetual conflict, and that should guide us. And then we ought to bring our allies along. The allies don't tell the United States what to do. We will tell the allies in that region what is in our strategic interest, and they need to follow our lead. And so I would just lead as the Biden administration, saying America wants this deal. We don't want to be entangled in more conflict in the Middle East, and we expect that you will help us achieving it.
Speaking of perpetual conflict, I want to mention an opinion piece you wrote with Senator Sanders last year in January 2020 about the Trump administration's posturing towards Iran as military tensions escalated between Tehran and Washington in the region. You and Senator Sanders wrote that you had a sense of deja vu of the 2003 invasion of Iraq, when another Republican administration had lied about conflict with a Middle Eastern country and led to a war, which you called the worst foreign policy disaster in modern American history. Why did you have that sense of deja vu in January of last year?
Well, we knew that Trump's advisors, Bolton, Pompeo, were itching for conflict with Iran. And some of us in Congress were working very diligently, along with Republicans in the Freedom Caucus, to restrict the president from escalating. And we passed a war powers resolution. We passed an amendment in the House to restrict support for Iran, any war for Iran and with Iran. And those things, I think, made a big difference in constraining the hawks in the administration. Unfortunately, the president, Trump, didn't escalate the situation and listen to what Congress wanted.
Mm-hmm. And in general, when it comes to wars, American presidents seem to have an immense amount of power. But what role do you think Congress can play to provide more balance to this presidential power, especially in cases such as last year, when military escalation can potentially turn into a full-scale war?
Well, the role of Congress should be what's prescribed by Article 1. We ought to weigh in on matters of war and peace. We shouldn't delegate that to the executive branch. Too often, the executive branch has made decisions to get us into conflicts, whether that's in Yemen or Libya or in indirect conflict in Syria. And we have not, and as Congress, authorized it explicitly, or they're relying on some authorization 20 years earlier. So Congress needs to be more assertive in saying, we cannot have troops overseas engaged in hostilities. We cannot engage in any support for hostilities overseas if we don't have congressional authorization.
Going back to the Middle East, President Biden is taking a different approach than Donald Trump, both towards U.S. rivals like Iran, as well as allies like Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Israel. What do you think the United States should do or not to help bring sustainable peace and security in the region?
Well, the U.S. First should not get extricated in long conflicts there. That is not in our interest. That region is consumed too much of America's resources. Too many of our lives have been lost there. And so we have to figure out one way of extricating ourselves from the deep entanglement that we've had. Second, we have to prioritize human rights and in our conversations in the Middle East, and make it clear that we're not playing one power against another in terms of some balance of power politics, which is what we've done, building up Saddam Hussein and then destroying him, playing the Saudis against the Iranians. Instead, what we ought to say is that we want to encourage and support the development of countries that respect human rights and not play one against the other.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to the people of the region, and specifically the people of Iran, how do you think the United States can help and connect and support the Iranian people? Because the years of maximum pressure and the crippling sanctions didn't help in bringing any policy change to the Iranian government or helping the Iranian people. So what do you think is the right approach?
Well, one, the Iranian-American community is an amazing community to tap into. They've done extraordinarily well in technology, in the arts, in the academy, in the medical profession. And so cultivating that community and having that diaspora play a relationship or a role with reaching out to the Iranian people, I think helps build that relationship. And then two, having a direct relationship to the extent we can from a people-to-people basis with Iranians and understanding that many of them care about the arts and sciences and technology and innovation and fostering that.
Mm-hmm. And on people-to-people connections, the Trump administration enacted the travel ban, which prevented the very exchanges and connections that you were talking about. What was your assessment of that policy of maximum pressure and the damage that it had caused?
It did a tremendous amount of damage. First of all, it allowed Iran to build its nuclear capability. It did not work. I mean, Iran has 2.5 tons of enriched uranium, about 25 times more than when the beginning of the maximum pressure campaign. Second, the policy was blatantly unconstitutional. You can't discriminate against people based on their faith in America. And third, it was counterproductive because it didn't allow the people in Iran to see the extraordinary innovation and entrepreneurship and cultural diversity of America. And so to the extent that we want reform in Iran, we shouldn't close off the Iranian people from seeing and participating in conversations with Americans.
What do you say to opponents of diplomacy and negotiations with Iran who say that there are human rights abuses in Iran, or Iran has regional policies that go against the United States? What do you say to those critics, some of whom are your own colleagues in the U.S. Congress?
There are human rights violations in China. Doesn't mean that we don't have relationships with China. There are human rights violations in Brazil. We still have to have relationships with Brazil. The United States has to look at what is in our strategic interest, and it's not in our strategic interest to have perpetual conflict with Iran that puts our troops at risk, that puts us at risk of getting into another war. And of course, we have to stand up for human rights and our values, but we can't shun major countries and write off whole people because of the record of a regime. It's just not how America conducts foreign policy.
And how much can the United States do to help the situation of human rights in the region, in a country like Iran, which does not have official political relations with the United States? To what extent do you think the U.S. can have impact when it comes to human rights abuses in a country like Iran?
I think it's very difficult for the United States to make other countries liberal democracies. I think we can model what that's like. We can have diasporas like the Iranian American diaspora succeed, which they have, and highlight their stories. We can have people-to-people exchange. We can encourage artistic exchange, exchange of writing, and hope that the people of Iran themselves ultimately bring about reform and stand up for human rights. But I don't think it lends itself to a military solution.
Mm. And now I want to ask you a little bit about tech companies, since you also represent the Silicon Valley era, and specifically my first question about U.S. sanctions and how it relates to tech companies and some of their services, including, in many cases, free services. And for in the case of Iran, how these sanctions, U.S. sanctions, have basically prevented tech companies from providing these services and support to Iranian users. There are many examples when I speak to tech activists, from Google services such as Google Cloud to Amazon's web services, and Iranian users have had to rely on local versions of a lot of these applications, equivalents, to get by instead of having access to the Americans. Do you think sanctions should prevent ordinary citizens, like in a country like Iran, from using American services?
Well, I think it depends on what the service is. I mean, I think that access to the internet, in my view, is a basic human right. I'm not sure access to Facebook is a basic human right. So I think it depends on what the company is doing and providing, and whether those activities are central to human rights, and whether they're going to help lead to greater reform and democracy. I do think participating on social media can be a form to challenge state power, and probably something that we ought to have as an option for Iranians, given that the state has basically appropriated a lot of the internet and cracked down on the internet, and you have an authoritarian internet in Iran.
And so when we speak to both tech activists and also human rights activists, in some cases they're saying that the lack of these services or the prevention of these American services to Iranian users has actually led to more censorship and state control of the internet, has led companies to rely on what is sort of the local internet or local versions, and has had the reverse effect of exactly what you were talking about. And then there's also this issue of overcompliance, meaning sanctions provide a limit, create a limit to how much these tech companies can provide services, but some companies, because they just don't want to deal with the headache of U.S. sanctions, they overcomply as far as what's asked of them in the law. And we've had examples of even U.S. administrations, for example, under the Obama times, saying explicitly that such and such is a lot under the law, but companies still refusing to provide those services. What do you think is the solution to that? How can tech activists sort of get more responses and more transparency when it comes to these tech companies, some of which are, in fact, in your district?
Well, I think we have to articulate it in a broader context beyond Iran and talk about what are basic human rights in terms of access to the internet and the right to participation of speech. And if we can enshrine that into a law, then it can make sure that the American government doesn't have sanctions that abridge on those rights. And those rights can be apart from the sanctions. So I definitely think that's an area where we have to really define a human right of access to not just the internet, but speech on the internet.
Mm-hmm. And also on a similar, semi-relevant question on that issue, I want to ask you about toxicity on social media. There have been numerous reports about this issue attacking women, minority communities. There was an example of a report by Amnesty International that was titled, in fact, Toxic Twitter, and it explains how violence and abuse against women on Twitter has become a very common experience, from general nastiness to targeted harassment, even to direct threats. I personally have had my own address and home photos published on Twitter with calls for violence against my family as a female journalist. And these problems get even worse when it comes to languages other than English, such as Persian, Arabic, and you're familiar with some of the networks in the South Asian countries. What do you think would be the solution to this when it comes to the tech companies? Because we have seen action and responses when it comes to platform accountability in regards to the American right-wing networks, but not so much when it's foreign state-sponsored networks or when it's languages other than English.
Well, I am sorry you've had to go through that, and it's a very big problem. We in the United States need to have very clear standards that violence and harassment are not tolerated. And if they're U.S. companies, those standards should be applied to international forums. And maybe the U.S. courts should be open to people holding our companies accountable if those basic standards are not being met. So there has to be a standard about allowing for speech, but making sure that the speech isn't inciting violence or hatred.
But how do you think the companies that are providing these platforms, the social media companies, the tech companies, can be brought into this equation and basically be held responsible and accountable when it comes to their platforms?
The companies, I think, are taking measures like the Facebook Oversight Board and implementing standards, but we need regulation. We need to make sure that companies can't collect data without your consent, which would limit the amount that they can target or recommend incendiary content. We need to make sure that companies are forced to remove content that is inciting violence. We need to make sure that we're incentivizing companies to promote reasonable exchanges of ideas and not just promote sensational content.
Mm-hmm. And finally, Congressman, I want to ask you about domestic terrorism and the rise of the far right, which also connects to the internet. There has been an increasing wave of attacks on minority communities in the U.S. There was an insurrection at the U.S. Capitol where you work last January, supported by the U.S. president. There are mass campaigns of disinformation, conspiracies that eventually lead to this radicalization and potentially violence. What type of policy and action do you think needs to take place to prevent the rise of these attacks and basically to overcome them and to stop them?
Well, it's a very difficult question, and the country is going through, as you pointed out, a rise of hate crimes, a rise of attacks of people because of their ethnic background, their racial background, their religious background. So it's going to require a multi-pronged approach. One, we have to have better reporting and enforcement when it comes to hate crimes and hate incidents. Even those need to be reported. And we need to have a special task force at the Justice Department looking into enforcing hate crime reporting and also taking actions. Two, we need to check the role of social media in inciting violence and have better guardrails. Three, we need to have much more civic education in this country about the challenges we've had with race, with ethnicity, and really teach the values of tolerance and respect and pluralism starting in school. So it's a complex problem with probably many other facets to it, but you're right to note that it is becoming, unfortunately, more common in the United States and we have to address it.
And last question I want to ask you, if you think Donald Trump would be running again in the next presidential election, if there's any chance of him winning?
I don't think so. I don't see how he could put together a 50% coalition. But if there's one thing I've learned in American politics, it's you can never count on anything for 100%. So there are always surprises.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, Congressman, I want to thank you for joining the Iran podcast.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
That was Congressman Ro Khanna representing California's 17th district in the U.S. Congress. And thank you for listening to another episode of the Iran podcast. You can subscribe to us on your favorite podcast apps and follow us on Twitter at Iran Podcast. You can also support the podcast by going to anchor.fm/theIranPodcast and then you can click on support. Until next time, goodbye.